Well, hello, hello, and welcome once again to another exciting edition of a Beatles program that we call Things We Said Today. This is a weekly show on the Fab Four that focuses on things going on today in the Beatle world. I'm Ken Michaels. I'm one of the co-hosts of the show, best known for my syndicated radio program called Every Little Thing, being joined by my co-host, Steve Marinucci of Beatles Examiner. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Ken. Hello, everyone.
On today's show, we have a special guest with us on the phone. He's coming to us from Chicago at the Fest for Beatle Fans. And if you happen to attended the Fest for Beatle Fans back in March earlier this year in Secaucus, New Jersey, he was a guest there. And he has a very interesting story to tell because he was a Beatle for a very short period of time back in December of 1960. He actually played bass in the group for four live dates. And his name is Chaz Newby. Chaz, welcome to Things We Said Today.
And welcome to you, Ken. How are you?
We're doing great.
Good.
Part of the reason why you've been attending the Fest for Beatle Fans is that you are friends with Jim Birkenstadt, and Jim is the author of a new book on Jimmy Nicol, The Beatle Who Vanished.
Right.
And in fact, you wrote the foreword to that book.
That's right.
So why did you feel, was there a connection that you felt with Jimmy because he was, you know, a Beatle for a very short period of time?
That was the real motivation. I met Jim in London when he was doing his research for the book. He mentioned that there was a certain synergy between our own experiences, myself and Jimmy, but there was also a big difference. I mean, I played four gigs with the Beatles before they were known at all. You know, they really weren't well known in Liverpool when I played in late 60.
Mm-hmm.
They'd just come back from Hamburg, minus their bass player, and Pete Best, who was the drummer then, who was a good friend of mine, he got me the gig playing bass with them. When Jimmy played, the situation was totally different. The Beatles had just been over here, massive acclaim on the Ed Sullivan Show. They'd gone back home and they were planning a world tour. And the day before the tour was due to start, Ringo was taken into hospital, tonsillitis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in panic, the organizer, Epstein, they had to find a drummer who was capable of playing the Beatles songs, and Jimmy Nicol just fit the bill completely. I mean, he was a young guy, he was a year or so older than one or two of the Beatles. He fit Ringo's suit so that he could sit behind the skins and play. So I understand. I mean, I wasn't there, but I understand he just had a quick practice session of the repertoire they were going to do, and off he went. And in the eventuality, Jimmy played with the Beatles for about 2 weeks, 13, 14 days, and he played four locations. He played Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Hong Kong, and then Melbourne. So there was a synergy, a similarity between the two experiences, but the big difference, of course, was that in 1960, the Beatles were a local band who'd just come back from Germany, and they were about to really start their professional career. In 1964, the Beatles were known all over the world, and Jimmy's experience from a performing point of view was totally different. And the other difference, of course, was when I finished with the Beatles, I simply went back to college and carried on with my normal life. Jimmy was already a very successful professional drummer and then had to find ways of utilizing this newfound fame to his own advantage, I guess. And basically, that was the, if you like, the two different stories, the similarities and the differences. And that's what I tried to put into the foreword.
Not to get too far ahead of the story, Chaz, but Bill Harry suggests in his Beatles Encyclopedia that there was actually some beginnings of Beatlemania when you were with the band. Did you notice, I mean, was there something happening in the audience?
At the time, in England, the most popular band professionally, you know, in the hit parade, would be Cliff Richard and the Shadows. And the influences from the US at that time were, if I can use the word, emasculated Bobbies, you know, Bobby Vinton and Bobby V and Bobby Rydell. In other words, rock and roll appeared to have been cleaned up from the rock and roll that we first heard in Liverpool in the mid-50s onwards. Sort of thing. And the Beatles were, if you like, trying to go back to that classic rock and roll of Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and Elvis and Carl Perkins and Eddie Cochran. Whereas the other local bands in Liverpool were tending to try and keep up with what the trends were in 1960. So if you can imagine, the other bands would turn out on stage, they would be wearing suits and shirts with ties, and they'd be doing little dance steps on the stage to accompany the music. The Beatles turned up, black leather jackets, black leather trousers, cowboy boots, and proceeded to repeat the sort of show that they were doing in the clubs on the Raper Barn, the Mac Show, jumping up and down and stamping on the floor and generally creating mayhem. The Liverland Town Hall gig that you're talking about, that was a dance hall, right? So people went there to dance. The band that was on the stage was not important. They just provided the music for the people to dance to. And when this bunch of five guys, because at the time it was Paul, George, John, Pete Best and myself, when the curtains opened, Paul launched into Long Tall Sally raucously, and all the amps turned up to full power at the time, which wasn't very much. You can imagine it wasn't what the audience were expecting, and I think that's what sort of created the change. So the dancing stopped, and the people came, gravitated towards the stage to watch this performance rather than just listen to the music. You know?
You always hear about that Liverland Town Hall gig, which is where apparently they transformed into this tremendous band after three and a half months in Hamburg. Were you a fan of the Beatles prior to that, and were you able to observe what it was like before they went to Hamburg as opposed to when they came back?
Well, before they went to Hamburg, that they were, they'd done one professional tour, as I understand it. They played in Scotland as a backing group for
Johnny Gentle,
sort of upcoming singers, for one of the upcoming singers. What was his name? Johnny Gentle.
Right.
I didn't see any of that tour, but I remember my first contact with the three of them was in the Casbah Club in the August of 1959, when they were still called the Quarrymen. So I knew that they could play, but they were, how shall I say, they weren't significantly different from any of the other bands that were playing at the time. It was the consequence of their sort of long stay in Germany, that 4 months from August through December, and the sort of constant playing, the sort of 4 or 5 hours per night. And I think that they gelled into really, musically, they gelled into a tight outfit. And I think when, for instance, when the first gig they played when they came back at the Casbah Club, that was a private members club. So everybody in the place knew who they were. And everybody had seen them there before. But what they weren't prepared for was this sort of professionalism that they sort of absorbed during their 4 months in Germany. And so I think the Casbah Club was the start of people's recognition that the Beatles had changed from being just any other band from Liverpool into something special. And that message obviously got across to Liverland Town Hall, and that was the demonstration of really the people in the north end of the city. That was really the first time they'd seen the band play the way they could.
Yeah, I'm always reminded of when Paul has talked about what made the Beatles different from other bands. He was very proud of the fact that the Beatles would often listen to B-sides of singles and play those because he didn't want to repeat the same songs that other bands were doing if they were on the same bill.
Sure.
So were you exposed to that kind of thing with different material that the Beatles were doing at that time? And also, even early on, even in the Quarrymen days, there were those early Lennon-McCartney songs that once in a while they would do. It wasn't all covers. Did you do any of their original material?
No, I had never heard them do Lennon and McCartney songs up until the time I played with them. It was all covers, as far as I was aware.
Okay.
I later read and knew that the material existed. It's just that I never heard them perform it.
What were some of the songs that you guys did do?
Well, the repertoire was basically the same for all the four gigs we did. We opened up with Little Richard, Long Tall Sally. We always finished with the Ray Charles, What Did I Say? And in between, there was Wooden Heart by Elvis, was a popular song at the time, and Paul sang that. They also did a range of Carl Perkins songs and a range of Chuck Berry songs, Roll Over Beethoven and Johnny B. Good and rock and roll music, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one version, the Eddie Cochran version of the Ray Charles song, Hallelujah, I Love Her So. I remember they did that on four occasions.
Right.
Pretty good.
Now, before joining the Beatles, weren't you in Pete Best's band?
That's right, yes.
The Blackjacks?
Blackjacks.
Yeah.
Yep.
What was that like? Pretty much like the other bands, yeah. Playing the same covers?
Sure. We were playing all the same material. Well, mostly, yeah. So 80% of the songs we sang were the songs that I played with the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And it was the same source. You know, it was the classic American mid to late 50s rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
We played all the Carl Perkins songs and the Buddy Holly songs and Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry, just the same as the Beatles did, you know.
Did you ever get to know Stu Sutcliffe at all?
Unfortunately, I never met Stuart, because obviously the reason I was playing with him was because he was still in Germany. And then by the time I think he came back, I'm not sure, but I think he came back temporarily in February 61. And I'd already gone back to college by then, so I never got the opportunity to meet him.
Right.
Did Pete talk to you after he got fired from the Beatles?
No, he didn't. I've known Peter since I was at school, you know, and we've never discussed it. He's never brought the subject up, and I've never asked him.
You've remained friends with him to this day?
Absolutely, yes. Yes, we play. I mean, we played rugby together, we played in the same band. In 1999, when they reopened the Casbah after closing, Bill Barlow and myself and Kenny Brown and Pete got the Blackjacks together, and we played a few songs at the reopening as well. And Bill Barlow and myself, since the unfortunate passing of Ken Brown, Bill and myself have been up to the Casbah a few times since. Oh. And we're going at the end of this month as well.
Very nice. It's nice
to
hear that.
Nice.
Okay,
the thing is, I guess, you know, the world in general looks at Pete Best and remembers Pete Best as the guy who was the drummer with the Beatles. But to us, he's just the guy we knew at school. And, you know, we played in the same band, and we're still friends with him, and he's still friends with us, and we know his family, and he knows our family. And, you know, it's a different level of association, I think.
Is the story true that John Lennon asked you to join the Beatles?
Well, this seems to come up all the time. I can't imagine in my life. I mean, I read about all this much later. John, I think, and this is only my personal opinion, so please, it's not cast in concrete. But
okay.
I think John was simply trying to encourage other people to get out to Hamburg. That's what I think now. I don't think he was inviting me to replace Stuart, because Stuart was his closest friend.
Mm-hmm.
The reason Stuart was in the band was because of John, and I don't think John would have tried to weaken his position in any way.
Now, at that point, this is a very interesting time when you played with them, because it was like an interim period as far as bass players are concerned. Because, now, correct me if I'm wrong here, at this point, did Stu decide that he had left the group? Because we know that he wanted to pursue...
Well, I don't know, because I never met Stuart.
Well, didn't the band tell you anything?
I'm only going on information that I've read, you know, sort of 30, 40, 50 years later. So I have no idea what Stuart's motivations were at the time. I mean, I know that he stayed in Hamburg. I know that he formed this friendship with Astrid, and that she was a photographer at the Art College in Hamburg. And I'm sure there were times that he was considering his career as a muso or as an artist, but I have no details on that at all. I just don't know. It's only what I read subsequently, yeah, that he wanted to go back to the painting and Paul took over playing bass.
So at no point when you were with them, they ever discussed with you what the status was of the band as a bass player? It's just...
Not that I was aware of at the time, no.
Okay.
I think John, he definitely said, you know, you should get your ass into Hamburg because, you know, everybody's enjoying it. So my personal opinion is that he wasn't directly inviting me to be the bass player in the band. I think he's simply trying to expose it to other people so that everybody else could get on the wagon, you know.
Oh, Chaz, just for the record, you were playing bass. What was Paul playing?
He was playing a six-string guitar. He was just playing rhythm.
Rhythm?
It was a Rosetti Super 7. Yeah. and he just, he just reversed the strings on it and played it left-handed.
Did you sense any frustration with Paul that, I mean, this is only four dates that you were with him, so it's hard to even judge,
yeah,
but
yeah.
This was a guy that really didn't have a role in the band in the sense that John was really the rhythm guitarist and George was the lead guitarist and Paul would play rhythm along with John and occasionally play piano in the group, but he didn't have a strict role. So did you sense at all that...
I think it depends what you define by strict role. Nobody else could sing like Little Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw Paul as, at that time, you know, the three of them were the vocalists. And it never occurred to me that he didn't have a role to play in the band. I must be honest.
No, I'm only...
The band was like a collective, if you like.
I'm only thinking in terms of, beyond his voice, what his main musical instrument was to be.
I really couldn't comment. I didn't hear any comments one way or the other. I mean, I knew that he played the piano, and I've seen pictures of him from a time in Germany where he's playing the piano and Stuart is playing bass. But no, the subject didn't come up, and I didn't imagine there was a problem there.
Did he ever show interest in the bass when
you
were with him?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Well, certainly not in discussions with me. He simply told me what the chord progressions were, and I just watched John or George playing a guitar to see when the key changes were off the run.
Could you talk briefly about their personalities in the band at the time, how each one related to you and also related to the audience?
Well, they were all very friendly to me. I mean, as I said, it was Peter who introduced me to them as a band. I knew who they were anyway, and they knew who I was. So I didn't have problems one way or the other. You know, they would bear in mind this is not the famous, world well-renowned Beatles that we think of today.
That's right.
Four guys who were just enjoying themselves, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a temporary bass player. So I can remember going back to college in January and talking to people, and they were saying, you know, well, what did you do over the holiday? Oh, I went to visit my parents in London, or I went to visit. And when they asked me what did I do, I said, oh, I played bass for the rock and roll band. And it was literally at that level, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. In the context of history, that's fantastic too.
Absolutely right. But then you see, they weren't born famous. You know, they achieved their renown simply by the hard work that they put in performing and writing the songs. But when they were 18 and 19, there was no hint of that yet.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I would love
and
to
I
have...
suppose that's the nicest memory for me, because I knew them when they were just normal guys having a ball.
Yeah, I would love to have a recording of Paul singing Wooden Heart.
Yes. But I was impressed with his singing, actually, I must admit. Because I do remember that Litherland Town Hall gig when he opened up with Long Tall Sally. And as I say, Litherland Town Hall was a ballroom with a dance floor. And the curtains were drawn, and Bob Wooler, who got them the gig, I believe, he was on the microphone in the middle, and he was just about to say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, direct from Hamburg, it's the fabulous book. And he just about got to the letter B, and sort of Paul nudged him out of the way. And off we went into Long Tall Sally.
That's wonderful. Well, that's a great picture.
Yeah, it is. It's an image that stays with me. I can remember that. Yeah, they were stamping around and playing all this sort of classic rock and roll music, and I was the only one that didn't have the cowboy boots because they bought all those in Hamburg before. I was wearing normal shoes. You know, at the end of the gig, my feet were hurting terribly.
How long did they play?
Well, I would guess, and this is memory, so I have no concrete evidence, but I would guess they played about 10, 11 songs, that sort of thing. You know, so maybe half an hour, 40 minutes, that sort of thing.
Chaz, are there any photos of you at the Beatles? Because I myself haven't seen them. It'd be nice to see you in some photo with the others.
I have never seen photographs taken on those four gigs, no. I don't have any photographs of me with them. The only thing I have is a pastiche that was issued by the News of the World newspaper when it existed over here in the mid-90s. And they took a photograph of the Beatles, and then they took Ringo's face out, and then using sort of computer graphics, they put my face on top of Ringo's body. But I mean, it's totally fake. You know? The only person I imagine might have had photographs from that period would have been Paul's brother, Michael. Because Michael was into photography at the time.
Right.
And I'm sure he took photographs at that time. Whether I was in them, I have no idea. But that's the only thing I can think of.
Have you had any contact with Paul in recent years?
No.
Did you have any?
The only one of them that I've, since 1962, I saw them. Last time I spoke to them all was in 61. There was a riverboat shuffle with Acker Bilk's jazz band on the River Mersey. And I saw them then and spoke to them then. But since then, I've not spoken to them. I met George briefly in 1962, but only to say hello to him, how are things going, and that sort of thing. You know.
Was music something you were ever seriously considering for a career, or was it always just a fun thing on the side?
Oh, it was just a fun thing. It was just a hobby. And, I mean, it was a very pleasant hobby, and I did enjoy it, but I never imagined myself or desired to be a professional musician. You know.
That's wonderful. It's a great story. It really is, and especially against the, you know, the tension and everything that seemed to happen with Jimmy Nicol. Yours is such a happy story, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I think that was one of the motivations that Jim had for getting me to write down my thoughts. You know, that it was apparent from what Jim's research, the Jimmy Nicol experience, that mine was totally different, and I think that was the, if you like, the counterpoint. On the one hand, the similarities, and on the other hand, the differences between the two experiences.
Is Jim's book the first place that you've put down your experiences, or have you put him down in a longer form somewhere else?
No. But I've spoken to many of the Beatle authors, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's. And I've written, occasionally I've written, you know, a page for various people. But no, I must admit, the foreword, I took some care over the wording, shall we say, just to make sure it was absolutely right. And it was something that Jim could use for his book, because I realized how important it was when he first mentioned it. You know.
Right.
I didn't want to sort of appear flippant or noncommittal or ignorant of it. I just sort of, I wanted to put it down exactly as I thought, and as I say, I just outlined what I imagined would have been the similarities, and then sort of the counterpoint of the differences, and Jim seemed pleased with what I'd written, and it just went from there, and as a result, I've been on two trips to the US this year, so
yeah.
I've got a lot to thank Jim for.
Is one of the people you spoke up, one of the authors, Mark Lewison? Did you? I assume Mark Lewison talked to you about in the process of putting his biography together.
Mark Lewison. Well, yes, I've been in contact with Mark, and he knows that I've written the foreword for Jim's book.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, Mark was talking about you, Chaz, back when he wrote the Beatles Live book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he mentioned your name to me back then.
I got in touch with, Mark got in touch with me immediately after Peter's book had been published, which was, I might be a year or so out here. I think Pete's book was published '85, and I was chatting to Mark Lewison shortly afterwards by telephone. And then eventually we met and had a much more involved discussion.
What was it like?
And I've been in touch with Mark ever since. So.
Yeah. What was it like for you to observe the Beatles' massive success, being the biggest band in the world? Was there a time when you said,
well,
I can't
to
believe...
To be honest, I was really pleased for them. I mean, the chances of a band from Liverpool in 1960 making it successful, a success in the UK, the odds were all against them.
Mm.
I mean, all the business in music at that time was centered in London. And all the acts, all the bands seemed to have come from that area of the country. And certainly all the record producing was done there, all the music publishing was done there. And, you know, looking back, the Beatles, and particularly the influence of Brian Epstein, they overcame some hurdles to get the Beatles recorded and then to get records distributed. And the success they achieved was totally deserved. And on the one hand, I was pleased for them. On the other hand, I was quite surprised that they'd managed to jump all these hurdles and get through all these hoops, you know.
Mm.
And I think it's a credit to their work ethic and to Brian Epstein's intervention, you know, that they eventually did manage it.
Right. But to hear all the music that they came up with as a band, how amazing that catalog is, you got to take a look at that and say, wow, you know, I was in a band with these members and I knew them.
It must have
blown your mind to know that they were capable of coming up with so much incredible material.
Well, sure. And of course, one of the reasons was that they were just so driven and they were just so determined to succeed. I've spoken about this with, friends who were there at the same time, Bill Barlow, who played guitar with us in the Blackjacks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, when we were 18, 19, we'd sort of made a decision about what we wanted to do with our lives. You know, some people wanted to run their own business and be plumbers or electricians or whatever, and some people wanted to go to college and become lawyers and doctors and chemical engineers and physicists. Some of the people wanted to be teachers. These guys, right from the off, wanted to be professional musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't seem odd at the time. In other words, you know, everybody was deciding what to do with their life, and they just decided on this particular route, and other people had decided on different routes. And we were talking about it quite recently, Bill and I. The odd thing is that we all achieved our targets. You know, we all achieved the objectives that we had, which is quite remarkable, I suppose.
Now, you went on to study what exactly, Chaz?
Chemical engineering.
Okay. And are you still doing that now, or...?
No. I retired years ago. I retired in 98. What's that, 15 years ago.
Okay.
I've been a pensioner for 15 years. The last 10 years of my life, I went back to university and did a teaching qualification. I taught mathematics at a high school for the last few years of my life, working life.
Okay.
But I've been retired for a while now.
Well, good for you. You did exactly what you wanted to do.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that, you know, sort of boasting about it. It's just that was the way we felt. You know, that this is our life. That this is the experience we've had at school. We were all, sort of, certainly most of the people I knew had good education, you know, had the opportunity to choose, oh, this is where I'm going to open my own business. I'm going to become a reporter on a newspaper. You know, we had the choice of what we were going to do. And most of the young people that I was in the social group of at that time in my life, you know, they sort of achieved those things that they wanted to do. You know, become nurses and doctors and school teachers and plumbers and professional musicians.
Well, we've just about run out of time here, but we want to thank you, Chaz, for joining us and telling us your story with the Beatles.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Chaz.
When I get home and I talk to all my muso friends at home, you know, and I don't live in Liverpool now. I live in the middle of the country, you know, in a little rural area. And we go down to the pub and have a few beers and have a good laugh about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
I tell them I've been on these radio programs in the United States.
Well, this is actually the internet now.
Beg your pardon?
This is the internet now. It's not just the United States, so.
Well, of course.
It's worldwide. Yes. You can hear us anywhere.
Okay. Right. Well, I'll expect a message from Mars quite soon.
Well, that might happen. You never know.
You're dead right, it might, yes.
You know, we attract an unusual crowd, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to be attracted to your crowd.
And we're happy
thank you again,
us.
Chaz. This has been wonderful. It's been very enlightening.
Okay. I'm pleased that you enjoyed it. Thank you very much indeed.
So, for the Beatles, things we said today. This is Ken Michaels thanking you for joining us, thanking Chaz Newby for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
And Steve Marinucci saying thank you, Chaz, for spending some time with us. We had a wonderful talk, and we will see you next time.